on Wednesday, January 23rd. Great to see everybody here. Just a reminder, anyone who has cell phones, Blackberries, PDAs, etc., please make sure those are off so we don't have the joy of hearing them during this session. We are going to start, Representative Kopp, good to see you.
Good morning.
We're going to start with a public hearing. I'm going to open a public hearing on LC 68 relating to the nationally normed assessments. And this is in your packet, members. And I'd like to see if Jerry Berger would come forward, please. Start us off. Mr. Berger, thanks for being here. Greatly appreciated. Representative Clemens here. Good to see you, Representative. Are you nervous?
Yeah, I mean, you know, turn around and leaving if my phone rings.
Expecting a child any moment now.
Okay.
So.
But no news.
No, today's the official due date.
Okay.
Yeah, oh, that's important. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Chair Buckley, members of the committee, I'm Jerry Berger, and I'm here today as chair of the State Board of Education. First of all, I'd like to thank the committee for inviting me to a work group that was held in December. And since that work group, I took the ideas that were presented there back to the Oregon Board of Education and shared it with them. And so today, unlike other days, I'm speaking as the chair of the State Board of Education and not as an individual, because the board did take action on some concepts that they thought was very important in this bill. First of all, the board wanted to thank you for providing this opportunity for students in our secondary schools. This is a very, very important concept, and it's needed by our students, so they wanted to share that with you. Secondly, the concept that some school districts have already started testing their students, and they have a plan for their students and went to their own budgets to provide that opportunity for students. The board feels very strongly. They don't necessarily disagree that there should just be one vendor, because that is a scale, etc. But they do believe strongly, we do believe strongly, that a waiver opportunity for those districts who have started testing prior to this, and I believe even if they have a plan to have a waiver in the future, is a crucial concept. Local districts making decisions for their students, an ongoing K-12 plan, I think we should reinforce and we should welcome, because that's their job, and we should support them for that. I think those are really there's some technical questions that Cindy Hunt from the Department of Education might clarify when she testifies. I will leave that up to her, but the board greatly appreciates your efforts. And the waiver of districts that have started and letting districts make some choices, I think, is a very, very crucial concept. With that, I'd see if you have any questions.
Thank you, Chair Berger. Any questions, members? Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Chair Buckley. Chair Berger, my question, just so everybody in this room knows, I went to a conference this last weekend, and I'm just like a teacher. When you come back from a conference, you want to use the information you learned. But it was about how to use research and education to make good decisions. And so has the board discussed what they see as the best benefit or the purpose of this assessment?
Of this specific assessment, the discussion would be that many students don't think beyond perhaps even the present day, let alone the future. The districts that have adopted this, and the board's intent would be, this opportunity gives students an opportunity to look beyond and to look towards the future. Oftentimes we have exit exams or we have all kinds of things like that, but the planning for the future and opening students' eyes to that future, I think, is a major purpose of this type of testing. That's why I think it's so crucial for the waiver from the one test, because that's what districts have done. They're doing testing perhaps in this grade, leads to the next, you know, two years later. So it's a continuum of looking at where you are as an individual, And then what are you going to do in the future?
Thank you, Paul. And just for clarification for the committee, and it's not necessarily, it's a comment, not a question, Mr. Berger, that I think a number of us are coming into this discussion with all of us thinking possibly what's the purpose. And I think we need to define that clearly in our minds possibly before we do anything. I'm going to be trying to figure out and probe people's minds to articulate, well, why do you see this as important foundation? So I really appreciate your comment.
Yeah, Chair Buckley, Representative Comp. Any assessment, if you don't know why you're doing it and where you're going, perhaps a suspect. A really good point.
Yeah.
Here's what happened.
Thank you, Chair Buckley. One place that I thought Representative Comp was going to head, Jerry, was if the board had discussed, and I appreciate your comment about the benefit to the students and their guidance for the future, but one of my concerns has been, and I was kind of excited about the aspect of having one vendor for the benefit of statewide data for comparison. How does the board feel about, you know, giving up, if we go with multiple vendors or a waiver for the potential of multiple vendors, don't we lose that possibility of having uniform data?
Representative Huffman, Chair Buckley, members of the committee. The board has discussed that, and I think that becomes one of the major questions is why are you doing the testing? The board in its discussion, and now I'm going off a little bit because I'm not quite so, I always speak for myself too, as some of you know. We think the major purpose of this would be for planning purposes and future look at what your skills may be and where you go, and not for comparison purposes. The state does have a state report card. We do have testing that compares school districts and achievements. Our viewpoint would be this may not be the purpose for this test. We think this idea is more of a planning. Where do you go in the future? It's a motivator. It's finding out what you don't know. And it's really a great use for students and parents and educators working with those students.
Representative Greenlick.
Thank you. Hi, how are you doing today?
Great.
I have a couple of questions. One question is, my understanding is the DOE has a RFP out already for this. Is that correct?
I believe that is correct, yes.
Will this waiver affect in any way the response to that RFP? Is there any concern about that?
Representative Greenlake, members of the committee, I would let the experts, they're here, they can answer that.
We'll hear about that.
I don't think it does, but you better ask someone else.
All right.
Follow up.
Maybe you may not be the right one for this, but I have confidence in your ability to answer questions. So, my experience. I got a lot of lobbying on the CAM and the SIM from my grandkids who argued it was basically useless because it wasn't useless because it wasn't used for anything, was their view. It wasn't the SAT and it wasn't the ACT and it wasn't anything that would have any effect. Is there some sense that as a part of where we're going with this, that this will substitute for an exam that college-bound students might otherwise take?
Representative Greenlake.
In addition to that.
Chair Buckley, members of the committee. There is nothing more misunderstood than SIM and CAM.
Yeah, and I don't mean to get back. I don't mean to get back into that argument.
I need to say that.
I hear you.
I don't believe that this test, or when you waivers granted to do another test, in any way, is a substitute for the concepts in SIM and CAM.
No.
I didn't get your question.
I'm sorry I mentioned SIM and CAM.
Okay.
I should have known better. Their argument was that didn't replace anything that was going to happen. The question is, college-bound students are going to take ACTs or they're going to take SATs, they're going to take both.
Right.
Is this something that in any way will replace that, that will take the place of that, or are they going to end up taking this 10th grade assessment and a PSAT, say?
Representative Greenlick, Chair Buckley, members of the committee, this will not substitute for your typical college test for, that some institutions use for part of the admissions process. These are more of a way to gauge where you are at a point in time. They're used to say these are the courses you might want to take. If you are planning to be a nuclear scientist, you better take some of these. If you're trying to be a nurse, you might take some of these. And it also gives you a gauge of how you are with others, with the norming of the test of where you are and what you might have to go back and do over again that you didn't get. It's really a planning tool. It's a check on where you are at this point in time, and then the schools will be working with those students and the parents of, if you want to do X, here's some things you might need to do. These are some things you might consider. This test, these tests would not be a substitute for the ACT or the SAT.
Yeah,
Mr. Greenick.
How about the PSAT, which is taken in the 10th grade, as I remember?
Well, the Representative Greenlake, members of the committee, it perhaps the PSAT test, and I've been out of the business for a while, so I have to be careful, is a test that does give you information of where you are with your peers, and it also, I believe, it's the one that allows you to become eligible for some scholarships, et cetera, et cetera.
To be honest, yeah, it's a nomination.
But
national merit.
It's a national merit. But that's, and then people can argue what else the PSAT does or what someone else does, what their test does. That's another esoteric argument you could have. But I think students that are take the PSAT test, they learn some things, they get some ideas of how they've done, what they may need to take, and it does qualify them for some national merit scholarships.
One last, if I may, and perhaps somebody who's coming up after might answer this. Yeah, there's an RFP out, and one of the responses, I'm sure, is going to be the group that does the SAT. I forget which
college
group is it. Which the college board.
College board
group. So they might win this RFP to do this, and they would produce a test that a 10th grader would take that would be different than the PSAT that 10th graders would take that's produced by the same organization. Is that?
If I can...
I will let someone else
answer. We do have the representatives coming up from the different tests, so I'm going to push that question on you.
Good. Thank you.
Nice to listen. See what happens?
Is that your cell phone?
Sounds like we're in the dentist office.
Worse than the dentist office.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Berger, your comments, you started off with the Board of Education, Oregon State Board of Education, are you endorsing and supporting LC 68? Did I hear you say you're supporting the waiver to allow school districts already testing to continue to use their testing?
Cindy Hunt is going to ask you clarify a couple of technical things. With those clarifications, the board, the way it's written, with the waiver provisions in there, and recognizing what school districts have done, we're in support of LC. We're in support of it.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
All please.
Mr. Chair Berger, are we going to have this in writing? And could you please tell me, you know, I think everyone on this up here and everyone out there agrees that this is a great program for the students, and that's what we all want to make happen. I think this. I was enthusiastic about the testimony we had, how this can turn some of our young people around and put them on the college track, and I think that's very, very important. So, you know, when we passed this bill, and now we're having some second thoughts about it. Why did the school board of Oregon Board of Education weigh in at this point and not earlier in the process?
Representative Wisnett, Chair Buckley, members of the committee, I think in any legislative year, there's tons of things going on, and perhaps the State Board of Education missed it. I think we gave input to the Department of Ed regarding some of our concerns, which was a major thing on the waiver concern. We tried to get that information. Nobody from the state board testified to that, but we have had that concern, and we tried to get that out. So maybe we missed it.
And we would have it in writing.
If the committee would like something in writing, and we can easily do that.
That would be great. We'd appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Any additional questions? Thank you very much, Chair Burr. Members, just to note, page one of the draft, lines 9 and 10, the current statute does state what the purpose of the assessment is. It's to predict the success of students on and provide practice for students taking college entrance exams. That's the stated in statute currently. Can we have Morgan Allen and Doug Costi, please, from the department? Oh, and Cindy Hunt, too. Who didn't hesitate. She came up on her own.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Morgan Allen, Department of Education, and we'll bring our whole panel up at once if that's okay.
Absolutely.
Our purpose here today is, I know Cindy's going to answer some technical questions for the committee, but we're hoping to work through the draft amendments with the committee, answer any questions, because our goal for the department is to implement this the way the committee and the legislature wants to implement it. And so we have brought our esteemed panel before you today to help you work through that and answer questions. And we had some technical corrections that needed to be made to the bill, and then hopefully we can clarify some of the things, some of the questions that were asked of Chair Berger, and we can follow up on any of those. So we'll stand before that, and I'll turn it over to Cindy to walk through the draft, if that's okay, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Morgan. Cindy, welcome.
Hi, Cindy Hunt, Legal Affairs Coordinator for the Oregon Department of Education. When the department received the prior version of the draft, one of the questions we had was whether or not it allowed a waiver on an ongoing basis, not just for the 08-09 school year. And after discussing this with the chair and others, we were told that it should be for an ongoing basis. When we got the LC draft yesterday and reviewed it, we felt that there was still some confusion around that. And I had a conversation with the LC who drafted this, and she agreed. And we worked out some language, which I have there before you in the form of an amendment. And what that language does is that in the waiver section of the bill draft in section 2, on page 2, it, in subsection 2 specifically, it talks about the department is allowed to grant a waiver for one school year. And so where the confusion comes in is that just for 08-09 or just for a time period that is one school year. So the first thing that the amendment does is change the word one to a. So they're granting it, we're granting it for a school year. And then the second thing that's added is a line that says a school district may apply each school year for a waiver under this section. So it makes it very clear. Because as Morgan said, our interest is implementing what the committee's intent is.
Questions on that?
Thank you, and Chair Buckley and Cindy. It's my, and when we've had the meeting in December, I thought the agreement was that there would be only a waiver for one year, and so I'm on a different plane than what I'm hearing this, that school, I guess my question is, if I was in School District A and okay, so the assessment's going to happen next October. Okay, so then if I was the superintendent of schools and I did not want my school to participate in this, then I'd apply for a waiver and state my reasons why, and that waiver is granted. Now, so the following school year, the same superintendent still doesn't want his students to be assessed. Do they get another waiver?
Chair Buckley, Representative Comp, under this draft, yes, they do.
Okay. That's what
they may, I should say.
They may. Right. But they could apply for the waiver, and it would be up to it's up to the department to determine. Is the board
Chair Buckley, Representative Comp, it would be the discretion of the Department of Education.
Okay.
The State Board of Education could choose to adopt rules that set parameters for those waivers.
Okay.
As the policymaking body for the Department of Education. The only other exception is found in subsection 2C, where it very specifically directs the department to grant a waiver if a school district had a contract, you know, for 95% of its grade 10 students for the 06-07 school year. And so if we had a school district in that situation, this is very specifically directing us to grant the waiver.
Right. Just for the record, that was not my understanding of what we agreed to, but.
Very good. This is the sticking point, I think, in terms of the ability of the 2009 legislature. In a sense, Cindy, is this question, it could go either way, because the 2009 legislature is going to be able to weigh in on this and say, we want to clarify and make sure that the waiver program stops at a certain point?
Chair Buckley, that's totally at the discretion of the legislature. I mean, obviously, you could tell the department to grant waivers only for the 08-09 school year and only for school districts with very specific requirements or on an ongoing basis. It's, yeah, totally at your discretion.
Very good.
Yes.
Mr. Campbell, if it's seems right, reasonably, let's keep focusing on this and let's try to get something that we can both feel good about in terms of how we'll approach this.
That's what I was going to share, Chair Buckley, is I'm sure there's going to be some other clarifying questions that come up to see how this is all going to unfold. So.
And if I can ask our committee administrator for some guidance here, in terms of amendments at this point, my understanding from the Speaker's office is that we put the draft in to the process for February, but can we amend a draft in this committee hearing, or do we need to wait until we are actually in session to amend a draft?
Mr. Chair, what the committee could do today, if it so chose, is to move this bill with the amendment, suggested amendment, in which case it would just have to be signed off on the chair by the end of the week, or the committee could make a motion to move the bill as is without the amendment and have the amendment introduced during the session.
Thank you very much for that clarification.
Well, and Chair, for clarification, and so then, like any other time, the amendment that's currently proposed could be amendments to the amendment.
Of course.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah, well, yeah. Since we are in this special session, make sure the rules are still where we think they are.
Very good to be clear. Any Vice Chair Wisman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hunt,
could you do this in here?
Okay, you gave us this paper that says the intent is to clarify the Department of Education wavering, may grant a waiver. But now, with the draft that we have in front of us, and we haven't gotten that, but yours should be the one we should be talking about. Now we're putting the Board of Education involved in this. They're gonna provide the rules. So who's running the show? Is it the State Board of Education or is it Department?
Representative Wisnett, Chair Buckley, I would hope that the State Board of Education and the Department of Education work together on one team, and I think we do. The State Board of Education adopts rules and policies for the department to follow. And so in answer to your question,
Mr. Chair, how in the world did we, this is maybe to you and the minister, how did we not have that in the original draft that we... I just don't understand why we're sticking this in now and it wasn't. We're amending page 2, or the draft, is we're now adding under rules adopted by the Board of Education.
Mr. Chair? Yeah. An earlier draft did have that language with the Department of Education. It read Department of Education rather than the State Board. However, the Department of Education doesn't have rulemaking authority. Only the State Board does.
Correct.
So it would not have been proper to indicate that the department would make the rules with regard to the waiver. That has to come from the State Board.
I understand what you're saying. I just don't know if that reads or that's...
And we do have legislative counsel here as well, I think, still.
Also, Representative, wasn't it, Chair Buckley? The State Board of Education has very broad rulemaking authority over virtually anything the Department of Education administers. And that's found in other statutes that are not included here. So even if you have a section of law that's in front of you that doesn't specifically say the State Board of Education has authority to adopt rules, they do under another area of the law.
So these, that phrase could be omitted from this draft and it would still be, the consequences would be the same.
Correct.
Okay. Any additional questions on this point? Continue. Do you have anything else on your amendment?
I think I'm done unless someone has questions.
Mr. Chair, we could point out a couple of the changes that we had requested, if that would be helpful, on page 3, just to clarify for the committee. On page 3, section 2, sub 3, the department may use monies available under ORS 327-008. Some earlier versions of the draft inadvertently took the money for the test out of the department's general fund appropriation rather than the $550,000 appropriation that's currently in statute. So that's a change there. And section 2, sub 4, we wanted to clarify for the committee that if there is any funding available left in the $550,000 to provide reimbursement to districts to pay for tests under the waiver, that amount would not exceed the amount that the state tests cost. So, for example, if a district received a waiver and their test cost, say, $25 or $30, some hypothetical number, and we calculated somehow that the based on waivers and things that come in, that the average state test costs $12. We would not reimburse them more than $12. They would get up to $12. So there wouldn't be a windfall for districts who get a waiver and perhaps have a different test or a different system that's much more expensive than the state system. They would get the equivalent amount. So those are some things that we had requested to be in the draft as well.
So, Mr. Allen, you're saying the department does not wish to contribute this money to this purpose? I appreciate that. Just a clarification on your statement on subsection 4. As you understand it, then the districts that get a waiver are not, under the process we're looking at, they are not guaranteed any funding. That funding would only be available if the RFP comes in at a level that allows for.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, our understanding based on the law is that, as you know, we do have an RFP out right now, and depending on the cost and the contract that comes in, there may be some amount available to districts that receive waivers that is less than the total sum that would be required to cover their costs. So, for example, if the RFP comes back at $500,000 and we calculate it's going to cost us $40,000 or $50,000 to administer it and do the data collection and all that stuff, there may not be funding available for those districts that have waivers. That is possible. That may be more appropriate for the committee to consider going to the e-board and asking for more funding if the intention of the legislature is to provide a payment to districts that receive waivers. If we had some funding less than available, say we had $20,000 left, we would prorate it and distribute it to districts on a prorated basis, so every district might get $2 or $4. That would be how we would plan on implementing that under the current law.
Absolutely. Any questions on that? Representative Klim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we have any sense of how much the administration might cost?
Chair Buckley, Representative Clem, for the record, my name is Doug Koski, Assistant Superintendent, Assessment Information Services, Department of Education. Some rough estimates that have been thrown around are about $12, $13 per student for these type of tests.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. The administration portion, so how much of the $550 would be gone to the department?
Chair Buckley, Representative Clem, our initial estimate prior to these amendments was about $40,000 to set up the process.
Additional questions? Representative Helton.
Thank you, Chair Buckley. I apologize, but just so I understand, if we amended so that a school district could receive a waiver, I was reading in here that they would be reimbursed for the testing source of their choice. But that may not be totally true. If their costs were $12 per student for testing and the fundage was not there, they might be reimbursed at $3 or $4 per student. Am I hearing that right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Huffman, two scenarios would be a district that receives a waiver may not be reimbursed at all. For example, if the totality of the RFP and the administrative costs take the entirety of the $550,000, The what you see on page 3, sub 2, section 4, is our intention. We believe that we need to clarify this, was that we didn't believe that the legislature's intent would be for a district that gets a waiver and takes a different test than the state assessment, and that test costs, you know, $5 or $10 more per test than the state assessment. We didn't want to reimburse that district more. So if their test costs $20, their waived test costs $20, and the as Mr. Costi said, say the average state test costs $12 or $13, we would reimburse them up to the amount that districts get reimbursed for the state test, but not to exceed that. Conversely, the way this is written as well, for example, if a district had a test that was waived and that test only cost $8, we would only reimburse them $8. They wouldn't get $12, if that makes sense. And hopefully it clarifies.
Clarify, sir.
Yes, please. Yeah, just to note, Representative, I have great frustration with this. My intent in looking at the waivers was to allow districts, or to try to ensure districts that were offering the other test, the non-chosen test, to be reimbursed at the same level. And again, I would like to push as hard as I can that if there are X number of 10th graders in the state, and we're budgeting for X number of 10th graders, I would hope that the request for proposal is answered by a proposal that would fund the test for X number of 10th graders, allowing for enough money to fund the districts who are doing the alternative test or the wave test as well. So I do have frustration with that, and I do understand your pushback. You said we should go to the e-board, and all I can say is I'm frustrated with that, and if there's a way we can address it, I would be glad to do so.
Mr. Chair.
Vice Chair Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My concern is, did the Board of Education know this when they made their recommendation or endorsement? The financial deal?
Representative Wisnett, Chair Buckley, yes, they did, because when we presented it to the State Board, we talked about the financial implications, and they had a prior draft, and we presented to them that, you know, our concerns about the financial issues, and so that's what they had voted on is what you see here.
Representative Flynn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to clarify something that Representative Huffman asked. There's nothing in here that states, is there, that the folks who are requesting a waiver end up at the back of the line for the purposes, other than that they're capped at whatever everybody else is getting. But there's nothing that says that, let's say, you know, $550,000 is what we set aside, $40,000 is gone for administration, now you're at $510,000, the deal comes in, you know, the RFP comes in at $530,000, so we're down $20,000. There's nothing that says the waiver schools are the ones that lose their allotment first, is there?
Well, Representative Clem, or Chair Buckley, it's not specific, but where it is expressed by the legislature is, if you look at Section 1 in the draft, and this is existing language that mm-hmm. you adopted last session, it says the Department of Education shall contract. And so the Department of Education is required to contract for the statewide assessment, whereas the waiver section mm-hmm. is an option. And so, generally speaking, in implementing something like this, the priority would be given to the shall over the may.
One more follow-up.
Follow-up, Representative. Thank you.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. Thank you. And if that's not our intent, we need to probably figure out, you know, how to deal with that. And I guess my other question is, do we know, and this might be more for committee staff, do we know when they did the fiscal analysis of this bill originally, if they it intentionally assumed the department would eat the $40,000, or, I mean, is the $550,000 really based on that's how many students there are times the expected cost, or is that assuming administration also built into it and we just didn't get the language written correctly?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clem, my understanding is the $40,000 was assumed as an administrative cost on top of the cost of whatever the statewide contract was. And
so,
there,
so we thought it might be $510,000.
There's a lot, and I think one of the lobbyists here can back up that understanding.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Green, if you do have questions about the RFP that you wanted to be covered by this panel?
Well, I mean, my basic question is, will this affect the responses to the RFP if responders don't know how many exams they're going to be providing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, I think that question, the representatives of those organizations are going to be equipped to that. We would assume that it might if there are some amendments adopted during the session. And we understand the Chair's frustration with the funding, and we've talked about that a little bit with him, and it's our hope that we could try to find a way to mitigate that as best we could throughout the RFP process. I would just remind the committee that this proposal and these amendments were brought forward by the original $550,000 in language. Those were brought forward by the vendors, not the department. And so I think the vendors are well aware of the amount of money that has been set aside and are probably adjusting their bids accordingly. But I think beyond that would be mere speculation on our part.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Greenlee.
Seems to me, let's say they bid $500,000 for the whole state, and that's for however many 10th graders there are statewide. And you say, well, is there going to be room as a contingency in that response to the RFP that if they have 10% less students, they'll charge 10% less money?
Chair Buckley, Representative Greenlick. The current wording of the RFP does not take into account a per test reimbursement process. However, that is a change that we're considering putting into the proposal or the request for proposals that will basically allow for that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Any further questions for this panel? What's going to happen?
Chair Buckley, I'm just not comfortable with the shall and the may part of it. If a school district is going to look at this and make some assumptions that there's a good possibility that they'll be reimbursed, and they go ahead and contract with another vendor, and then they find out that there's not enough money left, they're at the end of the train, the boxcar, if you will, and they're left holding the bag for the testing. Am I missing something?
I think the timing, if anybody would like to address it, the timing of the RFP would give the school districts, I think, ample advance notice that by if we went through with the kind of financial outlook we're looking at right now, they would have the timing to know that as a part of applying for a waiver, they'd be applying for the ability to continue with the test they've been having but would most likely not receive state funding to continue the test they've been using. I hope that answer is clear. We had districts come and testify in September concerning their use of the test. And I can't remember, were you here at that? And if you recall, both districts who were both using the two different products, I asked them directly, if you knew that you were not going to get state money for continuation of your test, would you go to the other test? And they both said no. They would stay with their own test. So I believe if there's some confirmation the panel would give that the request for proposal will be done early enough so that districts understand what the parameters are for the 2008-2009 school year.
Mr. Chair, that is correct, and I also believe obviously the department and Mr. Costi will watch very closely the amendments and any language that comes from the legislature and would do what we could within the open RFP process period to modify that to try to alleviate some of the concerns that were raised here today.
For the questions, who's going to represent Clem?
One more on this whole shall may thing. So there's a shall for people who were already contracting last year with somebody else. So they are in this position as people who are part of the RFP. And it's the mays are the people who weren't doing it last year with somebody else, so they're not being really grandfathered. They just want to go a different direction. They weren't doing it differently before, but they now want to go a different direction, and they're at the end of the boxcar because they're a main, not a shall.
Representative Clem, Chair Buckley, that's correct, although the shall is for granting the waiver and not necessarily for reimbursing those districts.
And is that... And is that different than in other places where there says shall reimburse the districts? And I see the shall contract with a nonprofit, shall base the selection criteria, shall provide an assessment.
Representative Clem, Chair Buckley, the The part about the money is on page 3. And it's in subsection 3 where it talks about the department may use the monies available to the department for the administration of the section and to provide funding to school districts that receive a waiver.
See if I could step in. If that, on page 3, line 1, if that was changed to shall, in reality, does that change anything? Because we're talking about monies available.
Yeah.
So if the RFP comes back and there's only, you know, $30,000 left available to the department after fulfilling the RFP, would then be mandating the department to use that $30,000 to distribute, which is the intent the department just stated. So I'm just asking whether it would make any difference.
Chair Buckley, I don't think it would make any difference because even if it said shall, we can only use up to $550,000 right. from the state school fund, right. so we're limited by that. So we would still have to prorate the amount of money available to those school districts.
Can we just a reminder, obviously we have still continuing questions on this. We're going to hear from other people, but our goal for today is to see if we can pass this on to February for drafting as a bill for us to further debate in February. We need to get these questions on the table, though, so I'm not trying to rush the process at all. I would like to make sure everyone has the questions, the information they need from today, and they have a list of questions they want us to tackle between now and the first week of February when we'd be hearing this this bill in its actual form. What's your comment?
My only comment is every English teacher in the nation should be proud that we're talking about shall and may in terms that have great impact.
We'll send a notice out to them immediately.
Let's do a press release. We really do things that have impact.
Yeah, except I learned in English and Latin that shall is the imperative only in the first person.
That's
and that it switches to will.
Representative Green, we're going to do an informational hearing on that in February. Any additional questions for this panel? Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate your work on this issue and your patience with the mind nudging. Can we have, should we bring Matt Marquis and Ozzy Rose up together? You guys okay coming up together? Come on.
Sorry, I got one black guy.
I didn't say last time I sat with him, I didn't do well.
Yeah, right. You can sit on the bar chairs there. He did that too?
Clarify, though, that was not me.
Oh my God.
This was Dad.
It was Dad.
Dad's laid up. No.
Well, welcome. Good to see you both. Thanks for being here.
Go ahead. Okay, first of all, you guys are talking about what words mean and your reference to the special session. In my view, every session's a special session.
So appreciate that.
Ms. Keep that in mind as you back here next month. Seriously, I have a couple thoughts.
Please identify yourself for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. For the record, I'm Ozzy Rose. I am representing ACT Corporation, who is one of the organizations that will be submitting a response to the RFP. The LC 68 we are in support of, and the fundamental issue, with all the discussion aside, is if districts who have made a good faith effort to get into the norm reference testing process, can they continue with the test that they're using and get the reimbursement that other districts would get under the contract? And none of us know at this time who might get the RFP, so this becomes moot for one group or the other. I also do not know the numbers, people that use the PSAT at the 10th grade. By the way, it's normally given at the 11th grade under the current process for an intake SATs as a senior. But the point, if the language stays the same, it appears to me that the board and or the department has the right to waive. If you're going to do some other test or under any, whatever conditions they decide to set up by rule, or and we'll know that in advance. The shall identifies a specific situation under which they must grant the waiver. and that's the 95% participation, and that you started in 2007. I checked with Beaverton yesterday, and their average daily attendance for 10th graders runs around 90%. So the issue of meeting a 95% participation, plus you have some parents who don't want their youngsters to take the test, you have some other group students who may just not have the English language yet, they're new to the country or whatever. So the 95% becomes a significant hurdle to get over. Although on the other hand, unlike some of the other kinds of testing, this test can be given one day, and then you can have makeup periods over a short period of time and get another chance to drive that up. But the 95% is a very high barrier. The other issue, 2006 and 2007 versus 2007-2008, that came out of our work group where we were trying to reach a way to assure that districts don't just jump into this and claim a waiver on short term. But I want to share with you the data I handed out to you is the number of districts and the number of students currently under contract for being tested next year through the ACT process. And you'll note that in all 8th, 9th, 10th, and 11th, it's a series of tests aimed at what you were discussing earlier. Why do you do this testing? You do it to help kids get where they need to go by the time they graduate and move on to high school. One of the Beaver administrators told me yesterday that all kids are capable of AP work if they get the support, starting with assessment and then support where their weaknesses are, et cetera. So that's the purpose of this set of testing. I think that's when it was brought to you originally. And so all we're trying to do is about 20% of all 8th, 9th, and 10th, and 11th graders are going to be tested under this process, under the ACT process. And if ACT wins the RFP, then it's not an issue to them. But the College Board also has a significant number of people they're testing now, so that it becomes. And that's how we got into this whole discussion, as you know. The seven of the districts I shared with you, the seven that are doing 10th grade for the first time this year, 2007-2008, which they would not qualify under the mandated waiver. But if you'll note, all seven of them aren't just testing grade 10. They're going to test grades 9, 8, 9, 10, and 11. And the 11th grade test is the test comparable to when you're applying to go to college. But it's a system that helps kids when they're just getting out of middle school, going into high school, plan for the future, help parents know what kind of support they need, help teachers know, and give direction to the school about its curriculum. That's what this discussion is all about. And we would like to argue that you ought to write the bill so that districts who've already made the investment in this type of process can continue to use that process and get the reimbursement that you're offering through the RFP or the statewide contract. Now, the other issue about that, how much money? Is there enough money? There are, in 2005-06, there were 45,000 10th graders. And if the number's approximately the same, if all of them were tested, that's $1,220 per student at $550,000. If only 90% of them, when you take out summer absent or whatever, which is a reasonable estimate, it's about $1,353 a student. Both the ACT testing and the PSAT stuff is less than $12 at the present time, the way it's being done. So we are confident that it's going to come in below that number, and there will be sufficient money not only to pay the bills at this department, and the department needs to be paid, by the way, this is a fair amount of work for them, but pay that bill and still have the money to reimburse both the WAVE student or WAVE districts and the regular districts. One thing Representative Kant said earlier in her example, a superintendent in this next fall wants a waiver for this year and gets that waiver. And then in the example, the second year, the superintendent still doesn't want to test their children and gets a waiver. We don't read this as ever a waiver to a district who doesn't want to test their children. The waiver process is only there to allow districts to do something different that still meets the objectives of the bill. And this is where the rulemaking process with the department and or the state board, I don't really care exactly how you call that, but they will have a set of rules or policies, and to allow any district to just get a waiver because I don't want to give these kind of tests. That, I think, is clearly against the intent and language of the original bill. So I don't think that's the issue. The issue is districts who have invested in norm tests for the purpose of helping their kids make good decisions, find out where their strengths and weaknesses are, and move on through the high school experience to be successful after that experience, whether it's college or something else, they ought to be able to build on that investment. With that, I'll answer any questions you might or might not have.
Thank you, Mr. Rose. Any questions?
Chair Buckley.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you. So, Ozzie, you would be... Okay, who has their phone on vibrate? Ozzie, are you suggesting that you would be happy in Section 3 on page 3 at the top if we change the wording, the department, from may to shall, so that we have shall all the way through? So that the school district that gets the waiver is guaranteed that they'll get reimbursed?
That would be fine. Although, again, I'm not too uptight about that.
I think it's going to happen anyway.
I do believe there's enough money. And the other side of that point is if we don't get any of this passed, those districts get nothing. And some of you had said, well, they're going to do it anyway, so we won't pay them. That's patently unfair to do that, I think. And I do believe that there is sufficient funding, given what we know about prices and the number of kids, that there will be money to now accept the shell. That's stronger language, but I don't think it's necessary for the purpose that I'm at this table.
Very good. Any additional questions?
Vice Chair Wisner.
Vice Chair Wisner. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Rose, you talked about the 95%. I want to be sure I understand that. So paragraph, what is it, section 2, section C, 1C, I guess. Okay, walk me through that. So what, well, you're saying the data you have is that we're not, the school districts are not going to have 95% participation, so no one's going to be able to get the waiver. Excuse me, that waiver is automatic. They shall grant that waiver.
Right.
The other paragraphs above that give them the authority to grant waivers other than the 95%. And I'm sure they'll have rules that won't require 95%. They will require that you've been in this process and that you are given a norm reference test that meets the objectives of the original bill. But I was just suggesting that I don't think many districts, if any, will meet the requirement that they automatically get a waiver. They'll have to get an action on the part of the department to get a waiver.
So, Mr. Chair,
please follow.
No, for you, or, and why did we just pick the one school year? So you're saying, okay, let me be sure I understand. You're saying that no one's going to get the waiver automatically. They're going to apply for it. That's what you're saying. Under this paragraph, it says if you have the 95, you get the waiver.
Well, you had to have the 95% and test in 2006, 2007.
How many schools are we talking about, Mr. Reza?
We've got 12 schools, and 7 of them started in 07, 08. So you got 6 or 7 that were doing it before in the 06, 07. And if this were the requirements for a waiver, I'd be asking for different numbers. I'd lower the 95 and I'd change the 06, 07 to 07, 08. But this paragraph only gives an automatic waiver. And I'm confident that in the process of seeking waivers that the state board and the department will recognize some of the arguments of the school districts about why they want to continue doing what they're doing. You know, Beaverton's been in it 4 years and Some of the districts have been in it 3 years. The seven new districts, if you'll look at that data that started this year, they're testing four grades of kids. In your school district, Representative, over 1,100, 1,200 kids in all four grades. They've made a significant commitment to the idea that kids benefit from this kind of testing, and in the long term, they will do better in school, move further, et cetera, et cetera. Same reasons that any of you that are very involved in this have for doing it, I think.
Any clarification from Cindy Hunt at all in terms of the waiver thing?
No, sir. But, Mr. Chair, last thing. So, Mr. Rose, the maximum number of schools, if SAT wins and we pass this bill, there'd be 11 schools, if this passes, would be able to continue to do ACT testing and being reimbursed. Because anyone can continue to use it right now.
Correct.
The question is the reimbursement.
Correct. I think with one exception, it says they shall contract the entity to test all 10th graders. And I don't know if that lets a district opt out and not do anything. I would think their rules wouldn't do that. I think that Representative Compton would really be ticked if that were how that ended up. But that was never the intention.
If you need clarification, I'd be glad to bring Cindy back up. But as far as my reading of the bill, and Cindy, if you would come back up just to clarify, that there's not a waiver possibility here that would allow a district to not, I'm being double negative here, but Cindy, can I just pose a question directly? Is there a waiver possibility that would allow a district to not offer any assessment to their 10th grade students?
Mm-hmm. Chair Buckley, no. The way we're reading this is that they either would have to give the statewide test, or if they asked for a waiver, then they could give their own test that met the same purposes as the statewide test. But in hearing Mr. Rose's comments, and I'd be interested in Mr. Marquis's comments, is if you don't have any school districts that meet the requirements of this paragraph C, then why do you have it in the bill? I would either remove it or lower the requirements so that you have some school districts that meet it.
Representative Klim?
So I just wanted to correct something that I'm saying, at least. In section, well, on page 2, section, well, I guess it's coming from the page 1, section 1, but down in 3, you can not test a student individually upon request of a parent. And a select group of students could also not be tested at all under rules to be adopted later. And I don't know which group or what the rules would say. I mean, I'm sure there's an example out there that we're thinking of where there's some class of students who otherwise couldn't be. So those are places where students could not be, because I think it's important for a lot of people that the parent should be able to opt an individual student out. The only odd thing about that language is in one place the contractor is waiving the assessment, and the other is the school district is waiving the assessment, and I'm not sure that that's the way it's supposed to be. It's probably the school district who should always be waiving the assessment, not a contractor.
Can you point out where the contractor is?
It's in where we are putting in the new under rules adopted by the State Board of Education.
Right.
That one's got the contractor waiving an assessment, and I don't know if the contractor wants to be put in that spot. It's probably the school district who needs to do it for the group of students, just like they're the ones who can do it for an individual student based on parents. I'm not good at writing actual statutes, but that's just my Chuck Riley plain talk work.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Greenlee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure this is a question to any of them, more an issue of discussion among ourselves, but Mr. Rose's statement that it would be unfair to allow a school district to opt out and not reimburse them. Anybody that's raised three teenagers knows when you start talking about what's fair and what's not fair, it becomes a rapidly an existential discussion that's beyond us. But my understanding of this, to begin with, is some school districts have decided to do this because it makes sense, and they've decided to pay for it because it makes sense. And now we're imposing a state restriction on them that may have a different outcome than the outcome they decided they want. And it seems to me what they were asking for, at least in the first sense, was to say, don't push this other thing out. We're not talking about money here.
Right.
We're talking about we've made a decision, and we want to use our decision. We want to have the ability to do that. And I mean, it almost seems to me that this question of reimbursing them is confusing the basic issue that's in this LC. And am I missing something in this discussion?
Representative, the only response I would give is the what was brought forth in the work group, the idea that if there are districts that have done this, they shouldn't be, in some sense, perhaps they should be rewarded for doing this for their students instead of it being seen as possibly being punished because they've stepped forward, they've done this by themselves, and now the state's going to come in and say, we'll pay for everybody else to do what you've already done.
Well, no good deed goes unpunished, as we all know. So this came out of the work group.
This did, right. Well, this is always my intent. Just to be very clear, this is always my intent.
To have them reimbursed.
To have every district that is providing a test for their students, a 10th grade student, to be reimbursed.
That meets the criteria.
Yes? On the existential side of fairness, one thing is different. The state isn't paying for this. You're taking the money out of the state school fund, which would be distributed on a per-student base to every school district.
Right.
And so now if you tell these people, you can opt out, but you're not going to get any reimbursement. It's a small amount of money, but it's a big principle to people who worry about equity and my share and all that stuff.
What's your comment?
Just a comment. It's more for the committee. Just two things. First of all, the intent of this original bill is it is to provide every 10th grader an opportunity unless that student and that parent decide to opt out. I appreciate the list of the few schools. When we're talking 7, 12, 15 schools that are doing the ACT over a continuum of time, not just 10th grade, but any educator could do nothing but applaud what the work that they're doing. But from their perspective, I don't know what their goals were and what their objectives were when they started their process with their school board and their school district. And so I think it's a little unfair to compare a district that can provide this kind of academic support to their students to districts that have not been able to do that, because it's my experience every school district will do everything they can to create a better and the most productive environment for their children. So I just want to clarify that part of it, that a 10th grade test isn't going to solve the problems of the world, but it is an opportunity for all students at the most, hopefully, the economical and reliable cost that we can do that. So, yeah.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Roland, good to see you. You got your work done quickly.
We did. We're a very efficient committee.
The implication is taken there.
Mr. Markey, I knew you'd be waiting for me.
You've been very patient.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Matt Markey, representing the College Board today. I'm going to start off before I get into all of the components here of the LC draft. I want to just answer a couple of questions that were asked prior to me testifying today. I think it was Representative Huffman stated some, talked about statewide data. And while this, I agree with members of this committee and others that have testified that it was never the intention of this legislation to look at comparison probably of district to district and statewide data or even putting it in the report card. But by allowing a waiver process, you will prevent yourselves from ever going down that route. If the legislature decides or the Department of Ed decides that this is something that they would like to report on in a report card situation about schools, you're going to limit that ability by allowing this waiver process and not having a statewide test. And to answer Representative Greenlick's question earlier about using a nationally normed assessment in place of a state-created assessment for the purposes of No Child Left Behind and that sort of thing. Well, I don't have a position today on whether or not that's a good or a bad thing. If you were going to go down that route, whatever test you chose would have to be done on a statewide basis. It probably wouldn't be a test like we're looking at today, but it would be an ACT or an SAT type of test, and it would probably have to be altered. But to do that, it would have to be done on a statewide basis, and everybody would have to take the same test. looking at, and then quickly on the RFP, the RFP was definitely issued on January 11th. I think responses are due back by the 5th of February, and I think they're looking at having a contract in place by around the first part of March. And I don't know how people are going to bid on that. I'm not involved in that process. That's something that somebody else does way above my pay scale. But
actually, probably below your pay scale.
Thank you, Representative.
But you know, everybody here is focused about ACT and the College Board and how those bids might come in. There are probably other assessment companies that may bid on this. And in fact, I know of a couple that are looking at it. And I think this afternoon we'll probably have a better idea of who's going to bid on the contract and who doesn't. And even when Doug testified saying, you know, they may change the requirements of how things are bid on and look at it for a per-student basis rather than an overall statewide contract, I don't know how the College Board's going to bid. I don't know how anybody else is going to bid. But if you're going to have them bid on a per-student basis even, and there's 45,000 students in the state, that's a pretty big spectrum of students. If all of a sudden you cut that down 20%, as Ozzie just mentioned, that's a whole different set of students. And now by looking at, on page 2, sub 1 here, where you allow a waiver process that is indefinitely going to go into the future as far as who can apply and who can't apply, that amount of students is going to change greatly over time. Every year it could be a different amount of students. To allow somebody to bid on that is going to be very difficult if you don't know how many students you're looking at. And then in doing so, you're creating extra costs on the department. And while we've had a lot of talk here today about will there be enough money to pay for a waiver or not, looking beyond that nobody's really talked about yet is, if now we have multiple assessment companies, and today maybe there's only 2 that qualify, but maybe tomorrow there's 4 or 5 that qualify and districts are doing different things. The department, because this legislation is really geared towards allowing everybody the opportunity to take a test like this, the department is going to have to make every effort to make sure every student has that opportunity. If you have 5 different assessment companies out there, or even 2, the department's going to have to track students. Students move. They're not always in the same districts year after year or even month after month. And if you have several different assessment companies out there all giving a test on a different day, as students move, you're not going to know where they're at, and the department's going to have to keep track of those students. That's going to require some sort of financial responsibility on their part to do so. So that, we haven't talked about that. I don't know how much that costs. I'm guessing that I know that that was never thought of in the $550,000 because we were talking about one test at that point. So I have no idea what the expense is on that. To the LC draft in particular, I was surprised, I guess, a little bit to read it and see that it doesn't link anything back to the original criteria of the legislation. It does talk about a college entrance exam, and I know, Mr. Chair, you had pointed out that on the first page of the draft you talked about that. If you read the preamble of the original legislation, it talks about identifying kids for more rigorous classes and allowing students to take some classes that they might not otherwise be identified for. So by not going back to the original criteria of the bill, again, I think you could potentially be opening up this for more assessment companies. And I'm not saying that's good or bad necessarily, but again, that whole price of administering the program is going to go up with that. So I think that it's odd to me that we would allow a student or a school district to make a decision for a student that says, we're going to opt you out of this statewide test that does A, B, C, D, and E that we outlined for everybody in the state because your district only wants to focus on one thing, and that's college entrance. To me, that ought to be the student's choice rather than a school district's choice. Looking at the waiver itself as far as who can apply and who can't apply, I did sit in on the work group, and while I didn't agree with everything that went on at the work group, it was my understanding that we were looking at a set place and time as far as contracts that were in 2006 or 2007 or whatever date that was. I didn't ever even hear a discussion about let's look into the future as far as that would work. The other thing that the criteria in the legislation requires is some really good tools that allow for the student, the teacher, and the parent to help them understand the assessment. The assessment itself is one thing, but there's also training that goes involved for teachers and staff to learn how to use the assessment in their classrooms to help identify these kids to help them advance in their learning process. With this waiver, all of that is lost to a certain degree because we're not requiring any of that to take place. Nothing in the original legislation requires a district to stop doing what they're doing today. In fact, you heard back in September that districts said, we're going to continue doing what they're doing. I'm not sure. Students have the opportunity. Groups of students now have the opportunity to opt out. I think that's important. You should allow that to happen. But to have a whole district opt out, I think, is a little overkill. I mean, I guess we could come in and ask for... We have high schools that have agreements with us to issue to all of their 10th grade students, the PSAT. I guess we could come in here and argue that it should be broader than just a school district and it should go down to the high schools because different high schools do different things. You have a lot of students across the state taking both of these tests that we're talking about today currently. I don't think there's any harm in taking both of the tests. So with that, I guess... We're trying to answer, it seems to me, a lot of problems that we don't know what the problems are. I think the next school year, things are going to happen just like they happened last year. We'll have a statewide test as well. There may be some students that take two tests. We could probably see how that goes and address any problems that arise in 2009, because right now, I don't think we know what the problems really are. So I guess with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'll just have some questions off of some of your comments. One, just a comment. There's a strong desire of the work group, the vast majority of the work group, that a waiver process do come into place. It can again be reviewed in 2009 legislature of how that is working for districts. When you make the comments about never being able to go to a statewide test, I would suggest that there might be the possibility, there's always the possibility that the department could work with districts over a period of years and say, in 2011, 2012, we're going to go to a statewide test. So how are we going to get there? We're going to go here, 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 and here until we're there. So the idea that this waiver process would somehow eliminate any option for a statewide test to ever be put in place, I simply think isn't quite accurate.
And Mr. Chair, can I just comment briefly on that? I don't want to get into a whole debate, but I think if you leave Section C in here and you're going to allow a waiver process to go for more than 1 year, those districts that have a contract in place as of 2006, 2007, and 95%, I don't know how many districts that is. Ozzy said maybe it's nobody. I don't know. But those districts at least would then be allowed to.
Certainly. But laws can be changed.
Oh, no, absolutely.
That's what we kind of do here. So I just wanted to provide that.
And my only comment, Mr. Chair, was it would be harder to go down that road. The more assessment companies you bring into this mix, the more districts that are. I mean, if that's your intent to do that at some time, I don't know why you wouldn't limit that today rather than making it a harder decision with more districts doing different things.
Well, Representative Kopp and I have talked about starting an assessment company, and I think that we could actually.
I'm doing the research on it as we speak. No.
Any additional questions?
Not as we speak. That's
panel?
A violation.
Absolutely.
Mr. Chair.
That's your wisdom.
Matt, how many schools are paying for their own SAT tests now?
Mr. Chair.
Schools and school districts.
It would be a PSAT, and it's a handful. Somewhere around the neighborhood, less than six, I think, five or six, somewhere in that neighborhood. There are a few high schools across the state that do so as well. In fact, University of Oregon and Jefferson High last year fronted all the money for their 10th grade students to take the PSAT. So it's kind of a variety.
Follow up to this one?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Rose, of your school districts, are there any schools within the school districts, the handout you gave us, that are doing SAT versus ACT?
Ms. Chair, no, sir. These are all 10th graders that are being tested. Yeah. By the way, I'd comment on one other thing. The issue about whether it's a one-year waiver or not, the A versus one,
mm-hmm.
My preference is that it become an ongoing waiver till we sort out where we're going. On the other hand, if it's a one-year waiver, we can do something about that in 2009.
Correct.
If that's a sticking point. I mean,
I agree.
Every session is a special session, and we can meet again in 2009.
That's the spirit, Mr. Rose. President Rowland.
Just a clarifying question for me, because I just want to make sure that I have it right after having read it. But in Section 2, as I read the first part of that, that's basically saying that any time in the future, I could maybe take the same test that everybody does this year, but the next year, I decide I want to do a different one, my district could appeal to the board and ask them, would I get paid for a different one? And the following year, I could ask for another waiver for a different test. And I could take three different tests in 3 different years, and if they grant the waiver, as long as it did the one thing, which was predict college entrance. That would be allowable now with this legislation, as opposed to grandfathering the other people in. This is more of a opening it up to anybody to change anytime they want. Is that correct?
Chair Buckley, Representative Roblin, you're correct. I know the way that we're reading this at the department is that a school district could choose for the 08-09 school year, for example, to not request a waiver, and then for 09-10 come and say, we would like a waiver now, and then, you know, we would look at the criteria and consider that.
And so I guess my concern there would be there's no certainty with respect to any statewide contract we do for the one test out in the future, how many people would be taking it. So if I were, that could have an effect on the bidding process that's happening right now. Would that be true?
Chair Buckley, Representative Roblin, correct. I believe Doug earlier testified about that, that one of the things we're looking at is making the RFP on a per-student basis, because that would give more flexibility with changes based on waivers.
But it may cause them to think, I mean, if I knew I had 100,000 as opposed to I could have 100,000, that might make a difference in how I put out my bid.
At this point, yeah, we don't know that. We would have to, you know, it'd be speculative. I don't know if these two gentlemen who represent those companies would have other comments on that. But.
Mr. Chair, Representative Roblin, again, I don't know how the College Board is going to bid it, and it sounds like Doug is trying to work on some language to try and change how bids may come in. But even on a per-student basis, like I mentioned earlier, if you have 40,000 versus 20,000 prices, depending on which company is bidding, may bid that totally different.
Thank you for bringing up that point. I think it's safe to say that the work group's intention was not to set up a system of you know, year after year confusion or uncertainty, that the intention was to grandfather. So if we can address that with further amendments to this, I would welcome that. Any additional questions for this panel? Thank you so much for your time. Appreciate it very much. We still have a couple more people that wanted to discuss this, Chuck Bennett and Tricia Yates. Chuck got tired of the entire conversation. He's clicking. Patricia's here.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Buckley and members. I am Tricia Yates with the Oregon School Boards Association, representing the state's 1,400 volunteer elected school board members. Thanks for the opportunity to comment today. And I want to thank the chair and members for inviting us to participate in the December work group. We appreciate the opportunity. I'm here today to express our support for LC 68 as a positive step in implementation of the original bill. And I'd like to echo State Board Chair Berger's comments in appreciating this draft, as recognizing that some school districts had already taken a leadership role in contracting for and administering the test to predict the success of students on college entrance exams. So we appreciate the waiver provision in respecting the previous decisions and leadership on the part of those local school boards and getting out in front on this type of assessment to support students. We think that the waiver option provides an appropriate vehicle to offset the costs for districts who have gone forward and reimburses those who are truly vested in this choice. In sum, we appreciate the flexibility inherent in this draft, recognize that it is still evolving, and appreciate the opportunity to express our support today. Thank you.
Thank you, Tricia. Questions? It was a real one.
It's kind of along the same line. I guess what I would be concerned about if I were a school board person is that with the language the way it's written now, a company who wants to come in and start doing their deal would come to individual boards and say, you know, we would really like to have your contract, the state pay, and here's the other kinds of things that we want to offer with our program and why it's better and so on. And so it would be putting individual boards on the line with regard to being pressured by different groups or, you know, sales from those different groups to change at different times and for different reasons. Is that Do you see that as a positive or a problem with respect to how that information then is used to help kids move forward?
Representative Roble and Chair Buckley, thank you for the question. I guess with the school board leaders with whom I'm familiar, I would trust their judgment in assessing the information provided to them by the test vendor. And I also know that with the process of the department working with school districts to approve the waiver, I would think that those kinds of concerns would arise. So I would trust the judgment of our school board leaders in making those decisions.
Further questions? Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I know Chuck is here to Chuck Bennett. Is there anyone else who wish to add comments on this? If not, I think we're going to take a. Chuck's not going to know. Okay, we take a quick break, maybe a 3-minute break here, and we'll come back to this in just a couple minutes. So stay in recess. This is the public hearing on LC-68. I'm going to open up a work session on LC-68. Vice Chair Comp.
Chair Buckley.
Let me do this for you, Mr.
Chair. Well, thank you so much, Dana.
Have a script for me. Okay. I'm going to make my motion, and I'd like to make a comment on record.
If you want to go ahead and make the motion first, I'll have you first in line for the comments. Yeah.
Okay. I move LC-68 forward for the February special session for consideration.
Vice Chair Comp moves that LC-68 be recommended for introduction at the February 2008 special session. Discussion, Representative Comp.
Thank you. This bill has a huge importance to me in many ways, and besides wanting to be a researcher, maybe when I grow up, I don't think so. Politics is a lot more fun. But I think there's some things we need to work out, and so I think we need to do that with a little bit more time, and so that we do have the special session to do that.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Roman.
I will vote to have this go forward, but I have real reservations with it. And I want people to know clearly that it has no relation to how I would vote on this in when it becomes a bill in our committee, because, and you've known this for a long time, I've had these discussions, I really believe that this is a tool that can be used in high schools throughout the state that we don't currently have, and that is we have a very mobile population of high school students, and when counselors meet kids for the first time coming in as a junior or senior in their schools and they're trying quickly to place those kids, when they get their information about them, they get grades, but grades are not transferable from school to school necessarily. The state testing is very difficult to get the information you need to make good placement decisions. These are the kinds of tools that can help make placements. And if everybody's doing the same one, the knowledge that builds up amongst the counselors in the state and their ability to put people in the right places fairly quickly at a time when it's important for those kids to come into a school is real important. And I think the one vendor kind of thing is a better way to go. It's my own personal opinion. I understand that a number of people have invested a lot of time, and those counselors in those areas have developed a lot of skill with respect to this test. And in some of these tests, there's multiple years to them, and that information is really helpful for them in understanding their kids. So I don't want to take that away. So I look at the grandfathering in some as an option. I don't like the idea that it opens up and every year they can change things. That really is frustrating to me. And I appreciate the chair's comment that was really not the intent of this. And so I think it has a fair amount, from my perspective, a fair amount of work. I don't know of a school, and I was just talking about that has 95% of the kids taking any test right now. Because when you look, a number of our kids with disabilities don't take these tests, and for most of our schools they average that at about 11%. So if even 5 or 6% of those kids are not taking these tests because their parents and others have decided they didn't want them to have to do it, that would disqualify those from that part of it. So I couldn't go with just the bottom part either, so if you're going to do it. So I think we have some work to do, and I appreciate the opportunity to do that. So that's kind of where I'm at right now.
Thank you, Representative. Further discussion? Vice Chair Wisnant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think a lot of work's been done on this. I was not on the work group. I see the benefit of proceeding with the bill as it is. I think then we could go back and look at the waiver. However, there's not the votes. I think there's been a lot of discussion today about the draft that needs to be clarified. And since it's going to have to be changed anyway, I will give the chair a courtesy yes vote so we can continue to try to make this better. I think we have to look at the scale of economies and the financial impact of any changes to the draft and the bill we passed last session. Thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chair. Representative Huffman.
Yes, Chair Buckley. I agree with what I've heard here. I agree to move it forward, but I am also in agreement with everybody. I think there needs to be a lot of work on the language and intent.
Thank you, Representative. Any additional discussion? Hearing none, the clerk, please call the roll.
Representative
Plum.
Aye.
Representative
Freeman.
Aye.
Representative
Huffman.
Aye.
Representative
Trumbull.
Excused.
Representative
Bliss.
Excused.
Representative
Roberts.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hall.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Whitman. Aye.
Yes, with understanding that I may change my vote in the committee.
Aye. The motion carries. And just to clarify, members, this was a courtesy vote to recommend the measure for introduction. It does not indicate a member's support for the measure at this time or any time in the future, and I do appreciate the courtesy from every member. We'll continue to work on this. Representative Wisnett, we'd like to make sure you're involved with any additional work groups on this issue. Thanks for everyone's time on this one. And we're going to move on to I'm going to close the work session on LC 68 and open a public hearing on LC 96. I would like to invite Dr. Drew Holliday and Valerie Lane, who have both come here from OIT, to discuss this. So thank you for your patience. I hope it was an educational experience for you listening to this for the past hour and a half. But I do appreciate the fact that you've come here from Klamath County, from OIT, to be with us today. Welcome.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Good morning, Chair Buckley, members of the committee. Joe Holliday, Vice President for Student Affairs at Oregon Institute of Technology.
Chair Buckley, members of the committee, I am Valerie Lane, the Director of Public Relations at Oregon Institute of Technology.
We're here, obviously, to speak in favor of Legislative Concept 96. On behalf of my friend, Gary Dow, the Dow family, and Oregon Institute of Technology, we thank you for pausing in your work to work on this resolution. I think the resolution does an excellent job of summarizing the life and the leadership and the legacy of President Dow. Her legacy includes, as you well know, because you helped make it so, the creation of the Oregon Center for Health Professions, which is now the Martha Ann Dow Oregon Center for Health Professions. And if Martha Ann were here, and I'm not sure she's not, I'm pretty sure she would try her best to push aside any personal accolades and say, can we please get back to work and finish the Oregon Center for Health Professions? Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you very much.
I would just like you all to understand that Aaron just handed out to you some information, Chair Buckley, and members of the committee, about President Dow. Dr. Dow was a remarkable human being, and the mere fact that you're taking the opportunity to honor her is very meaningful, not only to the Dow family, but to those of us that work so closely with her. She greatly respected the work that you do to make our state run at such an efficient level, and we appreciate the time that you've taken to honor and show respect to her. Thank you.
Very good. And just to respond quickly or briefly, I do hope that we'll be able to arrange a schedule so that if there are people from OIT who want to come when we have the vote on the House floor. I was tremendously impressed by Dr. Dow with her work. Very, very sad to hear about her. For passing, and the fact that OIT has made so much progress under her tenure has just been a tremendous asset to Southern Oregon in particular, but to the state as a whole. You know, I just wish tremendous great success for OIT in the future as you continue your work. Any other additional comments you would care to make at this point? If not, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you
for traveling to be here. I would close the public hearing on LC 96. I'd like to open up a work session on LC 96. Chair or Vice Chair Wisnett, would you care to make a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move committee send this bill LC draft to the Rules Committee.
You can just recommend it for introduction.
Okay, I'm sorry. That's I move LC be recommended for introduction at the February 2008 special session.
Vice Chair Wisnett has moved that LC 96 be recommended for introduction at the February 2008 special session. Is there any discussion? Is there any dissent? Hearing none, the motion carries. Thank you, committee members. I would like to open up a or close the work session on LC 96 and open up a public hearing on LC 79, our farm to school and school garden program. I think we have Deb Lippold is coming up first. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Buckley and members of the committee. Appreciate this opportunity to present our testimony to you. I'm Deborah Lippold, Director of Growing Gardens, which is a Portland nonprofit that digs at the root of hunger by building home gardens and supporting people for 3 years to grow great food. And also, we grow the future veggie eaters and growers, the next generation. We do after-school and school-based garden education. Thank you again, Chair Buckley, and members of the House Education Committee for your leadership in addressing the urgent needs in Oregon related to farm-to-school and school gardens in this 2008 supplemental session. We'd also like to thank and acknowledge Representative Brian Klem, Representative Tina Kotek, and Senator Brad Avakian for their leadership in inspiring and impressive bipartisan co-sponsorship during the last session and their continued leadership at this time. We ask you to forward LC 79 to the House Rules Committee for introduction as a House Committee bill for the 2008 session. We also request your continued leadership to make sure that this LC 79 legislation gets funded. Just for some background information, farm-to-school and school garden programs work systemically to improve childhood health and wellness, teach critical lessons about our food supply, and promote community connections between rural and urban Oregonians. Supported by this evidence, Representative Brian Klem and Representative Tina Kotek introduced a trio of bills during 2007, and you may remember seeing this lovely summary of and the over 80 supporters. HB 3307 would create a single focus position within the Department of Agriculture to ready the Oregon agricultural community to work with Oregon schools. HB 3476 would create a farm-to-school school garden program in the Department of Education and reimburse school districts that utilize Oregon products up to 7 cents for every meal served. HB 3185 would provide resources to schools throughout the state to promote garden-based education. As you may recall, these bills passed unanimously out of the House Subcommittee on Education Innovation, thank you very much, and also the full House Education Committee. The Joint Ways and Means Committee took no action on the three bills, although a farm-to-school position was established in the final iteration of the Oregon Department of Agriculture's budget. We're asking you to forward LC 79, which you have in your packets a summary of what this LC 79 intends. And we're asking you this because it's needed due to changes and opportunities that have occurred since the 2007 session. You also have a copy of this legislative concept draft, which I can get the pages separated here, which I refer you to. Essentially, LC 79 requests $95,000 from the general fund to create a pilot farm-to-school and school gardens program within the Department of Education that creates the capacity for ODE to assist school districts in utilizing Oregon food products and produce from school gardens, to promote food and garden-based educational activities, to coordinate farm-to-school and school garden activities with the district's local wellness policies, report to the 75th Legislative Assembly on activities conducted as part of the pilot program, and coordinate with the Oregon Farm-to-School School Gardens Program within the Oregon Department of Agriculture's farm-related activities. LC 79 also includes enabling language that permits ODE to accept private sources of funding to support the Farm to School School Gardens program. I'd like to introduce a few more panel members who can flesh out some of the details much better than I might be able to. First up, I'd like to introduce Oregon Department of Agriculture Assistant Director Dalton Hobbs, who will describe the ODA farm-to-school opportunities and critical needs for the ODE expertise. ODE Legislative Director Morgan Allen to present a letter of support from Superintendent Susan Castillo, and Oregon Department of Education School Nutrition Program Manager Heidi Dupuis to give some important information about ODE's farm-to-school and school gardens efforts to date and their limited capacity to meet existing needs.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Fine. Thank you. For the record, I'm Dalton Hobbs, Assistant Director for the Oregon Department of Agriculture in Portland, Oregon. I'm here today to speak in support of LC 79. Last session, as we heard earlier, the department was given a budget authority to hire a farm-to-school coordinator to increase utilization of farm products either grown or processed here in Oregon in our state schools. We have filled the position with Corey Schreiber, and I believe that progress to date has been encouraging. For instance, we've put together two Willamette Valley food processors, as well as the Portland Public Schools, to offer a cherry cobbler to students. And why this is important is that we're right in the middle of cherry growing area here, territory, but we are seeing a decline in the acreage that is producing cherries here in the Willamette Valley. And this was a real breakthrough because we're able to take a product that's normally sold fresh, but in this case was a canned product, and integrated it successfully into the school system. And I think we used a very successful model there, and I think we've got some very important opportunities here. So I think we're on the right track, and we look forward to reporting back to you during the 2009 session of what we feel are even more progress towards getting the considerable bounty here in Oregon in front of our school kids. Now, while the Department of Agriculture has considerable experience and knowledge of food production, processing, and distribution sectors, we really need a counterpart within the Department of Education to help us navigate and better understand the opportunities and how best to connect Oregon school districts, school lunch programs, and other feeding programs with Oregon agriculture. You know, we know how to get the food, and we know how to grow it and process it and all those things. But once you get into the school districts and the school systems, it is really this sort of unknown territory for us. And we need this counterpart person to help the considerably skillful people like Corey Schreiber to navigate this system. So LC-79 will help round out the early investment that the state has made at the Department of Agriculture, and will provide resources for the Department of Education to work with the Department of Agriculture to enhance utilization of school food products throughout the state. This is particularly important for smaller school districts that may not have the resources to work with the Department of Agriculture, like the Portland Public School District had with this cherry cobbler project. We hope that LC-79 moves forward during the February session, and that funding will be made available to support the position within the Department of Education so that we may optimize our efforts through the balance of the biennium. And I'd like to thank you for your interest, and I'd be happy to respond to questions if there are any.
Thank you very much. Any questions about cherry cobbler?
Samples.
Next time.
Hello again. For the record, Morgan Allen with the Department of Education, and first wanted to take a moment to thank the advocates of this bill. They did a great job working with us to help craft this. We had a couple of conference calls, and Cindy Hunt and I were involved in drafting the legislation. We feel like we have a quality bill product for you guys to consider today, so thank you to them for letting us weigh in and get it right the first time. So I wanted to share in your packet of information, there's a letter from Superintendent Castillo addressed to the co-chairs of Ways and Means in support of this. Superintendent supported the original legislation during the session and, again, is emphasizing her support and the department's support for the bill. We believe that if we can create this pilot program, we can really maximize the department's role in coordinating with the Department of Agriculture, as my colleague said from Ag. And it's, you know, we're really at this critical early stage in the development of farm-to-school and school-garden programs, and it gives us a jump on that for the next biennium. So it's, again, you'll probably hear this repeated many, many times, but this is a real win-win for Oregon's farmers, for our food processors, for the manufacturers to take advantage of the growing interest in Oregon agricultural products in local schools. And it's also an important step in making sure that we get higher quality meals to our Oregon students with higher nutrition values and all of the benefits that I think my colleague Heidi can talk about much better than I have. If you remember back in the session, there were about 80 organizations that supported the legislation. I believe that coalition is all back, probably with more groups as well. And I think it's part of a continuum of what you guys have been doing. If you remember back to the session, you passed legislation with new PE standards, with new school nutrition standards, with new curriculum requirements and training for prevention of performance-enhancing drugs and steroids. So the legislature has been taking a lot of positive steps forward in the continuum of nutrition and healthy education for students, and I think that this bill fits right into that. And as part of that, it gets a little bit distinct because we've had those changes since the session, and so it would be a missed opportunity if we didn't have this position in our department, the resources, and Heidi can talk about a little bit of this. We've done everything we can with our existing child nutrition program resources, but we just don't have the staff or the ability in our budget to carve out a full-time FTE to dedicate to work on this. We're happy and we'll be here every step of the way. The superintendent will be happy to weigh in with the committee or the Ways and Means Committee and answer any questions. And with that, I'll turn it over to my colleague, Heidi.
Thank you very much.
Hi. For the record, I'm Heidi Dupuy. I'm employed with the Department of Education as the manager for the school nutrition programs. Community and school districts want to use local products in their national school lunch and school breakfast program. And over the last 2 years, we've been meeting that need by doing some foundational works to identify farm-to-school materials that are available for school districts, as well as environmental support for the farm-to-school concept. This work was done with a few small contracts and available staff time. We have gone as far as we can go without a full-time position. And schools are still interested, and they need more support from us about how to proceed about developing farm-to-school in their individual school districts. This position that's in this legislative concept paper would build capacity at the local school districts for developing business relationships with local farmers as well as establishing school gardens. We are eager for the opportunity that this bill offers for positively impacting child health and wellness as well as local communities. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you very much. This committee is not a hard sell for you guys. Let you know, we've been very supportive of this from the start, and not just because of Representative Trump's pressure.
Chair Buckley.
Vice Chair Gump.
Upon the record, if the new nutrition specialist that works on this can work with the TAG coordinator, then we can double our results possibly.
Okay. Additional questions or comments? Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Very much appreciated. I think we have three other folks who would like to speak on this. Mel Rader, Chris Cable, and Christy Obink. Obink?
Chair Buckley, with your permission. I'm sorry, You need the intros?
You do the intros. Absolutely.
I apologize
I do, I'm sure.
for not understanding the protocol completely, but I would like to have an opportunity to introduce. We have three more total.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Mel Rader, as you mentioned, who is Program Director of Upstream Public Health, will describe a little bit more about the policy landscape that has been changing and underscores this critical need. Northwest Health Foundation Program Officer Chris Cable is going to also address the private philanthropic support for farm-to-school and school gardens as effective strategies for improving children's health.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Buckley, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mel Rader. I'm the project director for Upstream Public Health, which is a founding member of the Oregon Nutrition Policy Alliance. In 2003, Upstream Public Health proposed legislation, proposed to the legislature a bill to set school nutrition standards that became House Bill 2650, passed last session. Today I'm speaking in favor of the Farm to School and School Garden bill, and I want to talk a little bit about why it's important now, this year, rather than putting it off until next session. The Farm to School movement seeks to kickstart a new generation of school food products, which are better for the health of our kids and better for Oregon farmers, food processors, and manufacturers. Because of many changes on the local, state, and federal level, we have a time-sensitive opportunity to move forward with Farm to School and School Garden projects. And the largest bottleneck right now is at the Department of Education, which is what LC-79 would remedy. So some of the changes occurring on the school food landscape include, first, there is a farm to school coordinator was hired at the Department of Agriculture this January. Second, there was some new funding has been secured from the USDA to design 5 new school food products, which will be out this year. Third, the statewide school nutrition bill, House Bill 2650, puts in new school nutrition standards. And finally, new rules from the USDA are on the horizon to give greater accountability around school nutrition standards. Now, information around these changes have come to light either late in the 2007 session or after the session occurred. And they all underscore a need to act quickly so that we can have somebody at the Department of Education while these changes are occurring. Nutrition standards for House Bill 2650 go into effect for student stores, vending machines, and prepackaged a la carte items this July. And for house-made a la carte items, they go into effect July of 2009. And as products get phased out because of the new nutrition standards, it's really important and would be really great if a lot of these were replaced by Oregon Farm products. The Department of Ag has a one-time grant to develop some new products, which is a great step in the right direction, and also with the position of the Farm to School Coordinator can work really well with the agricultural community. But as we know, getting the food supply right is only half of the equation. We also need to get the demand side right, and in this case, this is the schools. Federal regulations around school foods literally fill up boxes and boxes of papers. And one school in Jervis is right nearby a pear orchard, and they would love to serve fresh pears from the farm right nearby. However, the barriers of federal regulations and the limited capacity within the school to process the food makes it difficult, and so they don't serve those pears. That's why we need the expertise of the Department of Education to assist them in understanding this tangle of federal regulations and so that they can really cut through the red tape and do the right thing, which we all support here, I think. And I'm happy to answer any questions about the urgency around the bill this year and why specifically how the Department of Education or how the new Farm to School Coordinator could take advantage of the changes in the school food landscape. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Buckley, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chris Cable. I'm with the Northwest Health Foundation based in Portland, Oregon. Northwest Health Foundation was founded 10 years ago with a mission to advance, support, and promote the health of communities in Oregon and Southwest Washington. Over the past 3 years, the prevention and reduction of youth and adult obesity has emerged as a top priority for the foundation. In the past quarter century, the prevalence of overweight in children aged 6 to 11 has more than doubled, while the prevalence of overweight in adolescents has more than tripled. These trends foretell troubling scenarios for the health of our nation, as research has shown that 80% of children who are overweight will become overweight or obese as adults. The future burden of obesity-related chronic disease threatens to overwhelm our health system and our economic viability without decisive action to reverse these trends. Since children consume about 40% of their daily caloric intake in the school environment, the food and beverage choices available within schools has been a prominent target for public health interventions. For many Oregon children, the meals they eat in school may be the primary source of nutrients they receive all day. This is especially true for the 43% of Oregon students who participate in the federal free and reduced lunch and breakfast program. Given the many regulations that accompany the meager federal funding for this program, school districts have little flexibility to improve the appeal and content of school meals with fresh, local products. In December 2007, the foundation approved a $296,000 grant out of our Kaiser Permanente Community Fund to fund a pilot farm-to-school program in one rural district, Jervis, and one urban district, Portland. The majority of this grant provides districts with a 7-cent per meal subsidy that had been included in House Bill 3476, presented in the 2007 general session, to purchase local Oregon-grown products. The grant also includes funding for EcoTrust to perform a rigorous analysis and evaluation of the effects of the program on students' nutritional behaviors, attitudes, and beliefs, as well as the economic effects for local agricultural businesses. We chose to fund this project for several reasons. First, sufficient research has been published to suggest that incorporating fresh local ingredients helps improve both the appeal and nutritional content of school meals, which in turn improves children's nutritional intake. Second, the evaluation component of this project has the potential to inform school nutrition policy discussions in the 2009 general session and beyond. Third, both farm-to-school and school garden programs have been promoted as strategies to improve child and adolescent nutrition in two important recent state reports. The first is a Healthy Active Oregon, the statewide physical activity and nutrition plan. The second is from the Oregon Health Policy Commission titled Promoting Physical Activity and Healthy Eating in Oregon's Children. This second report was specifically requested by the legislature last year. The Northwest Health Foundation is not alone in supporting farm-to-school and school-garden initiatives. The philanthropic sector, as well as local agricultural businesses, have coalesced around this issue to improve the nutritional environment for Oregon school children. While the philanthropic sector can play an important role in jump-starting community-based interventions and funding research to demonstrate the efficacy of these programs, it is not an adequate substitute for state support. Bringing farm-to-school programs to scale and ensuring the benefits are made available to every school district in Oregon requires state involvement. LC 79 will provide the Oregon Department of Education with a dedicated position to coordinate these efforts and provide school districts the support they need to purchase and incorporate fresh local agricultural products. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you this morning, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much. Any questions, members? Seeing none, I'll thank you for your time, and we'll see you next month.
Chair, we should thank the foundation for the almost triple what the state's put in so far.
Well said, Representative.
I'll accept that on behalf of the board, which I'm a member.
Thank you, Representative Greenman. Gentlemen, thank you. Did you have one additional?
Yes, center? Chair Buckley and members of the committee. We have one additional speaker, and I'd like to make some closing remarks,
Absolutely.
If that's all right.
You bet.
Thank you. So last but certainly not least, in fact, a very important voice to tell you what this need is on the ground at the school food service level is Christy Obink, Nutrition Services Director for Portland Public Schools.
Thank you, Chair Buckley, members of the committee. I know we're talking to the choir here, but if I can give you a few nuggets that you can share with your colleagues in future weeks, that would be great. My name again for the record is Christy Obink. I am the Director of Nutrition Services for Portland Public Schools. As you may have noticed, Portland Public Schools is in the middle of vast resources. All these folks that have spoken before me are at my fingertips. I can call them. I can get information when I need it. But I'm not the norm. Most of our kids go to schools in small schools. A lot of those schools are in rural areas. They don't have the support and the resources that I have. I'm fortunate I can work with ODA. They're right across the river. And so I can share with them some of what I know, but I don't think I should be the one to inform their work. I think it really needs to be statewide. We need to have a voice at the State Department Child Nutrition Program that can represent all kids in Oregon and what works in all communities in Oregon, not just down the Willamette Valley. So the State Department is already overstretched. I can tell you just by when I do need information from them. It's difficult. They're busy doing audits. They're busy helping other districts, and they just don't have the time to meet all our needs. This particular topic of farm-to-school is huge within our community. Last March, we held a statewide conference. The number of people that attended the farm-to-school workshops were tremendous. Over 80% of food service directors said that they would prefer to purchase local, but didn't have the resources, didn't know how to write the RFP. They just need help in this area. I get a lot of calls. I get a lot of calls about what's in the food that we serve. Parents want the label. They want the nutrition facts. And now phone calls have doubled. They want to know how they start a school garden. How can they get some of those garden products into the cafeteria to be served so kids have the opportunity to touch it, grow it, maybe procure it in the cafeteria, and then serve it to their fellow students. I don't have the answers to some of those questions. I need to be able to have somebody at the State Department that I can ask, what measures do we need to take to make sure the soil is okay? How many quarter cup servings are there in a 3-pound delicata squash? You know, I mean, these are questions that, you know, again, I might have some resources I can look it up, but most food service directors or cafeteria managers do not have that support. So I am asking you to move LC 79 forward so that the investment that's already made at ODA does not sit on the stockroom shelves of our cafeterias. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
We'll see you next month.
Chair Buckley and members of the committee, just to sum up, this testimony we hope has presented you with the information you need to recognize the urgent and unique nature of this request. I want to emphasize that what we're talking about is creating a pilot program, so an opportunity to create this interagency coordination, an opportunity to make sure that the investment that's already been made in creating the ODA farm-to-school coordinator position has the opportunity to really produce results so that we can then look at this in the longer term picture. We ask you to consider that this is really a small one-time investment, as I said, that we think is guaranteed to produce big, long-lasting returns. It maximizes your existing investments. It is distinct. It fills a void within ODE's child nutrition programs that they currently don't have the resources to fill, although they certainly have demonstrated their willingness and desire to do so. Oregonians really want Oregon foods on the school meal plates of Oregon school children. They want healthier children who eat the recommended daily amounts of fruits and vegetables. They want children who are physically active, who maintain a healthy body weight, who understand where food comes from, who know how to cook, how to grow, how to enjoy wholesome food, and that they value Oregon's abundant food and farm economy. I want to make sure to leave a lasting picture in your mind in that one pager we talk about the importance of the pollinator. And this really is what we're talking about. You have created some wonderful opportunities. There's blossoms out there. The potential is there. But we really need this position. It's going to help pollinate those blossoms so that we really do come out with a harvest instead of blossoms falling off the tree before the harvest gets here. So, and I do want to respond, Representative Comp, and to let folks of the audience know that there will be some tastes of that cherry cobbler downstairs in the cafeteria for any of the public who would like to sample that immediately following the hearing. We tried to do our best to make sure we were efficient with your use of time, but obviously if there are any other questions you have of the presenters, we'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you very much, Debbie. It's my understanding that Representative Kotek is working with your group on a letter to Ways and Means.
Correct.
and that this committee will have access to that letter in the first of February when we have our hearings on this bill.
Definitely.
Thank you so much for your time and your advocacy for this very wonderful issue, and I hope we can move it forward in February. We do have one person signed up. Patty Whitney Wise has signed up as well to offer comments on this LC.
Thank you very much, Chair Buckley and members of the committee. I'm Patty Whitney Wise with the Oregon Hunger Relief Task Force. Just a couple of additional comments. Most things have been covered. But for your consideration, one of the things we know at the task force is that a number of farmers struggle to stay in business, and many of their families are eligible for federal food programs. We look at this as one way of helping those small and mid-sized farmers with new markets in the state and hopefully stop the bleeding of farmers out of business in our state. Secondly, as these new markets develop, one of the other areas we're losing in Oregon are processors. And as we begin to create new markets, we hopefully will see a stem in the tide of losing processors and addition in new processors, which incidentally also helps the Oregon Food Bank, who often get bulk product that needs to be processed in order to pass it on to the people in their network. So we think both of these things are really important to consider as our economy is sort of struggling, maybe going a little bit south, that these will help actually create new markets for Oregon and help feed hungry families as well. So thank you for your time.
Thank you for being here. Thank you for your comments. Any questions? Hearing none. Is there anyone else who wanted to offer comments on this draft? Seeing no one, I'm going to close the public hearing on LC 79. I'm going to open up a work session on LC 79 and entertain a motion. Should we let the Representative Clem do the honors here?
Sure.
Pass down the script there.
Chair, I probably don't need the script, but let me just look. I move LC 79 be recommended for introduction at the February 2008 special session.
Representative Clem has moved LC 79 be recommended for introduction at the 2008 special session. Is there any discussion? Vice Chair Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I voted for this bill last time. I thought we were supposed to get bills if there's going to be no opposition to. Is there Democratic caucus ready to support this and move this forward?
I believe so. It's a Ways and Means question now. So we'll be discussing that. Representative Rowland.
Yeah, I think I have to do a conflict of interest. I helped build the garden at my wife's school, so I've already got this. I got my sweat equity in it already, and I just want to make sure that I do think it's important. And I guess my comment is, in this country, and in Oregon in particular, we grow the safest and best foods anywhere in the world and abundant. And Oregon is a rare place in that we can produce just about everything you would ever need. We wouldn't have to go outside of our state. Many states can't say the same thing. And we have a lot of other issues going on. And we'll also have the opportunity here to honor those sesquicentennial farms. There's a bill that's coming from the Senate. That are farms that have been in production with the same family for 150 years. And that says something about sustainability in Oregon. It says something about who we are as a state. And I concur with all the people who have spoken before, and my hope is that as these develop, that we'll actually have people from the urban areas coming out to see what farms really do and get an appreciation of how much hard work and the effort that goes in to produce some of the best food and the best produce in the world. And so they have a better understanding of where it comes. We find so often that many of the kids really have no idea where things come from any longer, and that connection to, where we used to be as an agrarian society where everybody grew their own food to a place where the supermarket and the container is where it comes from. We have to get back to an understanding so that they understand what we need to do to be successful in that enterprise. And this is just one of those, and I'm excited about doing it. And so, thanks.
Thank you, Representative Rubin. For the discussion? Representative Clem, do you have anything to say about this bill?
Well, briefly, actually. I probably should declare conflict of interest, on a legitimate level, just in case our cooperative involves himself in the program. We don't sell directly. We just put it into a co-op, and someone else figures out where it gets sold. But just in case Diamond Fruit Growers gets involved, then we could gain from it. And just the other pieces, I do feel like this nutritional standard, as those relationships, or as the new standards kick in, schools are going to begin forming relationships with who's going to supply what meets these new standards. And once you get into a relationship and a longer-term contract with somebody else, not an Oregon farmer, Oregon grower, Oregon cooperative, it's harder to undo it because institutions in general tend to follow the similar
contracting principles and relationships over time. And so I really do want to have that first round of how we're going to meet these standards be with Oregon products. And certainly, you know, the gentleman from Upstream talked about the benefit to the health of the Oregon child, and I'm also equally interested in the health of the Oregon agricultural economy, and this will help build a market. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative.
And I have a new baby due, you know, in a day or two, and she might want to eat this in 5 years.
She will be. Absolutely. Thanks, Chair Kump.
I can't resist Representative Clem. When I was recently up to Jefferson High School with Mayor Potter's contingent of wonderful people, and we're going through the lunch line, and they said proudly, this pear is from Oregon. I said, well, did it come from Representative Clem's farm? Yeah, I wanted to make sure I was okay.
Very good. Well, the motion is to move this forward to the February session, and since Aaron's been seen over there doing nothing, we'll have her call the roll.
Representative Clem.
Aye.
Representative Greenwich.
Aye.
Representative Huffman.
Aye.
Representative
Crummell.
Excused.
Representative Wynn.
Excused.
Representative Rogan.
Aye.
Vice Chair Kump.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnik.
Aye.
Chair Buckley.
Aye. The motion carries. Thank you, members. I'm going to close the work session on this draft. Yeah, pretty tough one. Yeah, there we go. That was combination. Members, we have on the agenda, we're going a little bit later than we intended to, at least that Dana and I intend to, but we're going to go for at least another half an hour here because we have the issue of the full-day kindergarten coming at us. That's a nice way to put it, isn't it? Yeah. It's with us. The Senate will be considering a bill that they'll be moving over to us on this issue. So Dana's invited Cindy Hunt to be here and Morgan, too, if you have any want to add it. Just to give the, if you please come up, I'm going to open up a public hearing. The kindergarten information here.
Were they?
I didn't know what they're doing.
Well, they might have been, Betty.
Yeah.
They were from our co-op, apparently. Sorry, Mr. Chair.
That's quite all right.
Well, it tasted very good.
There's a 1 in 150 chance.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you very much. So, Cindy Morgan, thanks for hanging with us. This is a very complicated issue, actually, when we get into it. So this is an informational meeting on the full-day kindergarten issue, and appreciate you being here. And whichever one wants to start, sure, to introduce where we are with this.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, again, Morgan Allen, Department of Education. And what is being passed out to you right now are a couple documents that we distributed at last Monday's Senate Education and General Government Committee, Superintendent Castillo's testimony on this issue, and a fact sheet that hopefully answers some of the potential questions of the committee surrounding full-day kindergarten, numbers of students, and where the students are.
Okay.
So, Mr. Chair, if it's all right, I won't read Superintendent Castillo's testimony verbatim, but I'll hit a couple highlights in there to sort of set up some background for the committee, and then we thought Cindy Hunt could walk through the bill draft with you guys, and then we will be available to answer any questions about the issue or how we got here today or any other things that might come up. So.
Very good, Morgan. Members, it's LC-44 in your packet.
So again, Mr. Chair, I'm going to just kind of hit some highlights in the superintendent's testimony from last Monday. December 18th of 2007, the Department of Education released an opinion from the Department of Justice indicating that school districts did not have the authority to charge tuition for full-day kindergarten. There's also a corresponding opinion from legislative counsel that has come out that reaffirms that as well. Essentially, just to kind of give you a sense of what the Attorney General's opinion said the Oregon, they basically concluded that if a school district offers more than a half-day kindergarten program, then that entire program is considered a part of their regular school program. Therefore, they cannot charge tuition to participate in that program. School districts can continue to use federal Title I money and other state and federal money and local money, so school improvement funds, state school funds, PTA money, scholarships, private grants, et cetera, to provide full-day kindergarten. Those funds are not impacted by the opinion. A couple things that I think the committee should be aware of is that the opinion is advisory to school districts and that the superintendent and the department have recommended that each school district seek advice from their own legal counsel on this issue and evaluate their own kindergarten programs based on that advice, because one thing we've learned through this process is that of the about 17 or 18 districts that currently do this practice, each one does it a little bit differently. The programs are set up and constructed and funded a little bit differently, so they should definitely consult their own legal advice. So as a result of this opinion, and without a legislative remedy of some sort, there could be and likely will be a disruption in schools across Oregon. We know that about 17 or 18 districts totaling about 2,500 students are in tuition programs right now. And many of the districts that are impacted by this advisory opinion and the LC opinion have been doing this for a long time. Weston and Wilsonville, I believe, was 15 years has been doing this. The Portland School District has been doing it for more than 10 years. Salem, Kaiser, Corvallis, other school districts, so this has been a long-time practice that has been going on. So the superintendent and department have been working very closely with the House and Senate leadership, the chairs of the education committees, OEA, COSA, OSBA, Stanford Children, other people have a stake in education. Particularly the impacted superintendents about what the best solution to this issue is. And last Monday at the Senate Education and General Government Committee, many of those impacted superintendents and those groups came up and talked about the bill draft before you that was introduced in support of it. So the bill has two essential elements. The first element is it protects districts from liability for present and past tuition charges. And Cindy could probably explain that a little better than I can, but essentially there is the possibility of some sort of statute of limitations, class action complaint for parents who have had their students enrolled in a kindergarten program that's charged tuition and whether or not they would be able to make a legal claim to that. The second part of the bill allows the districts to continue operating their programs as they're currently constructed through the 2009 and 2010 school year. I think the consensus of the superintendent and the education advocates and the people that have been involved in crafting this is that we need to find a bridge to get us to the 2009 legislative session that avoids disruptions and potential lawsuits and other things that may result because of this opinion, and that the place to talk about full-day kindergarten and how to fund that and how to implement that, and if that should be done, the appropriate venue for that is the 2009 legislative session. So just to make that very clear. The draft before you contains both those essential features, but I just want to make it very clear it does not change the state school fund, and it doesn't seek any kind of formula changes or provide any funding to the districts during the February special session. Again, our concerns are for really stability for the districts. If we don't address those issues raised by both the Attorney General's opinion and the Legislative Council, there can be disruptions potentially of class time and student learning. School districts could face lawsuits. Some districts may choose to change or discontinue their programs, and other districts may have to look within their own budgets to find funds to pay for that tuition to keep their programs going. So both the superintendent and the department have committed to work with the legislature and the other leaders in the education community to find a solution to get us to the 2009 legislative session. And we sort of, you know, this is the bill that the Senate Education and General Government Committee introduced. I believe it's going to be Senate Bill 1068. Dana, is that correct? And so this issue will continue to be worked in February. And then before I turn it over to Cindy, the other document before you is sort of some facts and figures about what's going on in kindergarten right now to give folks a sense of the scope of the issue in Oregon right now. I'll just hit a couple of these and then be happy to answer any questions. There's about 40,000 Oregon children enter public kindergarten each year. Our best numbers are that there are about 10,500 of those children enrolled in a full-day program, either paid for by the district, paid for by federal Title I money, paid for by tuition or some other means that the district comes up with. There's about 78 districts in total that offer full-day kindergarten, and we've put the list down there. So many, many of our districts offer full-day kindergarten. Starting on page 2 and going through page 3, what we've tried to do is there's a list of the school districts, the classes, the numbers of students to sort of give you an impact of where it's spread out. So it's all over. The Portland School District, being the largest district, obviously has the most classrooms that are impacted, but you'll see some small districts like Sisters, Junction City, urban districts like Weston, Wilsonville, Lake Oswego, other districts like Corvallis, Tiger, Tualatin, and Salem, Kaiser, you know, other small districts like Milton, Freewater that this practice goes on, so it's pretty widespread. So with those considerations, if you guys have any questions on any of those stuff, I'd be happy to answer any questions about the facts and figures or how we got here. We could do that after Cindy's testimony or right now, whatever the committee would prefer.
Certainly. And there were any questions on any of Morgan's testimony?
Representative Huffman.
Chair Buckley, thank you. Morgan, for the school districts that have the, is the all-day kindergarten an option, and the parents that have been paying tuition, could the parents have opted to send their child to half-day, or...
That's correct. And Cindy, please feel free to jump in and correct me if I'm wrong. But the school districts receive a half a weight in the state school fund formula to offer a half-day kindergarten program, and that is required. Many districts, as you can see, 78 of them, of those 78, about 18 of them have chosen to offer a full-day program to some or all of their students and have chosen to pay for it either by making investments from their general fund budget or charging parents tuition. In this case, the approximately 2,500 students, those parents basically enter into a contract with the school district and pay a monthly tuition. We see it range in about $200 to $300 per month is probably the average. So they are paying that above and beyond. So I hope that answers your question.
Well, so the parents were given an option, as far as you know.
That's correct.
They were not coerced in any way in entering into fees for full day.
That's correct. Chair Buckley and Representative Huffman, I think what we heard at the hearing from the superintendents that have these policies in place in the district is overwhelming support, and many of them have adopted a full-day program with tuition because of overwhelming parent demand within the district.
Any additional questions? Seeing none. Cindy?
Okay. Cindy Hunt, Legal Affairs Coordinator for the Oregon Department of Education. I think Morgan hit on the highlights of the LC 44 that's in front of you. Specifically, as he said, it only applies to the 07-08 school year, 08-09 and 09-10 to get basically these schools through the 09 legislature. It directs that school districts and charter schools may charge tuition for what the draft calls supplemental kindergarten, which is full-day kindergarten. Currently, the State Board of Education, in its standards, says that there's a certain number of hours per year that kindergarten must meet, and it works out to about 2.5 or 3 hours a day. So supplemental is anything above that. So it could be 4 hours, 5 hours, up to 6 hours, because that's the maximum amount set by rule. So then what the draft does is, so like I said, it very specifically allows the school districts and charter schools to charge tuition, which addresses the issue that was raised in the AG's opinion and the LC opinion. And then it says that if a school district or charter school does this, then they can't charge tuition for a low-income family. A low-income family is defined as one who is receiving free and reduced-price lunch, or a student who is a ward of a juvenile court or the Department of Human Services. And then it also allows, though, for those families who don't meet the definition of low-income family, that if they have a severe hardship, they can apply to that local school district for a waiver of the tuition. All of these provisions are modeled after the current law that's in question. Mm-hmm. And then the other big piece that this does, and it's contained in Section 4, is it validates the actions of the school districts and charter schools up to this point in charging tuition. And it does that retroactively. And with that, if there's any questions.
Questions, members? Mr. Chair Wisdom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Hunt, that's interesting. I agree, and I want to do this to help the school districts, but is that legal? Can you make it retroactive? And has that been talked to a lawyer about that?
Representative Wisnett, Chair Buckley, yes, it's legal. There's a section in the LC bill drafting manual on how to do that. And although the education committees traditionally don't see a lot of this in front of them, I can remember doing, I think, 2 in 15 years. But when you're over in the Judiciary Committee, a lot of times you'll see provisions like this involving court cases and things like that. And so, yes, there's a limited amount of things that actually the legislature can do retroactively, and it's things like involving crimes. You can't make something a crime, for example, after it happened. Some contract provisions, things like that. But items such as this where you're essentially giving some immunity to school districts are very legal.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Roblin.
I mean, it's clear, and it really has always been clear, that people who qualify for free and reduced lunch should not have been charged. If they had actually done that, if people had just not even said and come and paid, are those, we can't unretract. This bill would not, they would still have a claim for that, correct?
Chair Buckley, Representative Roland, potentially they would have a claim for that. And the AG's opinion very specifically does not address the low-income issue. The question that was asked is, may school districts charge tuition? And that's what was answered. But the low-income question is one of the reasons we're recommending to school districts that they consult with their own councils and look at their own practices and how they're doing this, and then decide how to go forward based on that advice.
Okay. Any further questions? Cindy, in terms of the intent of this bill, I know we've talked about any other possibilities to impress upon districts the desire from the legislature that no child be denied access because of revenue, because of their revenue status. And I think we've had some emails back and forth on that. After reading your emails, I'm now kind of looking at what you have here, saying this might be actually the strongest position we can take on it. Any further reflections on that?
Chair Buckley, I know one of the questions that you've specifically asked me is, could a school district deny admission to kindergarten based on income? And the answer is yes, they could. We do have another statute that's not in this bill that talks about what sort of categories a school district cannot discriminate based on. It's things like race, religion. Now sexual orientation is included in that. But what's not included is income. So a school district could deny admission, but once they admitted the child, they could not charge them tuition. So in talking to some of the school districts, some of the school districts are not charging tuition for low-income students, and it's not a factor of admission at all. Other school districts have, like, for example, two pots of students. They know they have enough money, for example, to fund 10 low-income students. So they're saying, we'll fund 10. If you're a low-income child, we'll put you in this pot. If we get 11 students, we draw out by lottery. And so that's part of what's going on out there. But, yeah, this draft specifically doesn't prohibit school districts from using that as a factor.
Further discussion?
And sadly, that continues to be a factor until we fully fund Head Start. Not all of those kids have that opportunity.
Right. That's good. No, we came close. We didn't
quite. 80%.
Yeah, I mean, of the people who generally, I don't know of anybody who wanted it, doesn't get into it now, but there was a time, I mean, in the past when we were there.
That was the same situation. Very good. Thank you for your comments. Thank you for your questions, members. Thank you for your time and for the information. Greatly appreciated. Look forward to seeing this move forward in February.
Why not just have him move it in?
I'm afraid that the Senate's already done that for us. Is there anything else? I'll close the informational hearing on the full-day kindergarten issue. Is there anything else for the good of the order? Seeing none, we are adjourned. Thank you, members.